And welcome back to Extra Featured Interviews. For some reason, Joe Grafassi has decided to come back. Why?
Because I love you.
You're insane, buddy. You're as mad as me. You make crazy movies.
You have been incredibly supportive, and I will not ever turn down an opportunity to be interviewed by you.
That's so kind of you. You keep sending me these great films, though. Maybe that's the problem.
I should strive to make a worse film.
No, please don't. I like them. I love how you stay on budget 9 times out of 10, I think. I love how you find neat ways of doing different things.
Thanks.
And I see that every film. Like, I know it's I've seen enough of your work now that I know it's you. And I see how you've changed in different films as I watch them.
I can look at my films, too, and see how I've grown.
And I think that's great.
You know, when you work with no money, you have to find creative ways to solve problems and get things done and make it look interesting. Because it's very easy to just set the camera on the tripod and just shoot something without moving the camera or doing anything fancy. And sometimes that's what the film calls for. Like Lars the Emo Kid was a lot of that because it was about the people, not the heavy production value.
Okay.
But something like Dead of Night, yeah, you got to get pretty creative.
Oh, good. You mentioned the film because I forgot to mention off the top Dead of Night. It's all good. So let's go into my favorite thing to talk about, which you already know what it is. Location, location, location.
Yes.
You have lots in this film.
There are a lot of locations, and I was a little frightened when Emilio gave me the script. Because, let me give you a little backstory about why Dead of Night exists, and that's Dead of Night with a K. I was out in California for a short time, in Los Angeles, and my friend Ming Wang and I were going to conventions, and we went to the Fangoria convention in Burbank when we began, and we met a filmmaker who was putting out films he made for $2,500, and they were not good, but and he knows that. But he was telling us how he'd sold 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 units of each of these films, and they cost him only $2,500 to make. And we put our minds together and decided, well, that's what we need to do. We need to make a low-budget film that we could shoot for under $5,000. So I met Emilio Iostello, the writer, online through, I think it was Inktip, and he sent me some scripts, and I loved his writing, but I couldn't afford to do what scripts he had. So I pitched him this idea of Dead of Night with a knight and a list of traits, and these victims represent this list. And that's all I gave him. And he developed that really great story out of that very loose idea. But I told him it needs to be very small. You know, minimal locations, minimal cast. And then he went off and wrote the script, and when he sent me the script, I loved the script, but I thought, wow, this is way too big, because you got the festival scene. With all those people, he wrote the festival scene in there. I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do that? But we decided to try it anyway. And it was a really great challenge trying to make the film that he wrote with the budget that we had, and I think we were pretty successful.
Okay, well, we can start there. There's my first question. Where's the festival scene? You couldn't have created all that. You must have known somebody with a festival or just shot at a festival.
It's a combination. The establishing scenes, the establishing shots were filmed in Austin, Texas, months after the film wrapped. So
can you break down to me what an establishing shot is, just so people know? I know what one is, but it just meant other people might not.
Okay, an establishing shot is what it exactly what it means. It establishes where you are.
Okay.
Like if a scene starts, you show a shot of the house, and then the scene then you go into the house to see the scene taking place. That's the establishing shot.
Perfect.
We established a couple of shots, big shots with lots of people at a festival to establish, okay, now we're at a Renaissance festival. Then we go in tight with our main actors at a completely different location, but it's kind of blended together.
Hold on. There are two different locations here?
Yes.
There's no way.
Establishing shots at the real festival were just me and Wayne Stevens going out filming pickup shots. Wayne was the knight, and he was just there because he was the contact to this festival, which was on the property of a game programmer who goes by the name Lord British. Do you know Lord British?
No, I don't. Sorry, can't help you on that one.
Are you familiar with the games Ultima?
Yes.
He created Ultima.
Okay.
And he let us go film on his property where he holds this festival.
Hold on. He has a whole medieval festival on his property?
This man, his real name is Richard Garriott, and if you look him up, he is a very successful computer programmer. He is a very wealthy man, and he has this all acres and acres of really beautiful property in Austin, Texas, and he lets this festival take place every year. It's the list, LYSTS.
And he let you film there for nothing, of course.
Yes. He just let us. They said, come on out and walk around. And if you notice, we see very few people's faces there because they're wearing masks and stuff. So we didn't have to get release forms from them because you can't tell who they are.
Correct.
So we just went there, filmed for a day, filmed as much as we could and picked the shots we loved. And yeah.
Okay. So the end of the film, I'm not really, quite near the end. You know, the changing scene I'm talking about?
Yes.
That's not on his property, then.
That's not on his property. That is a property in Houston. That's a parking lot of a haunted house attraction called Phobia. And Wayne, again, knew the Phobia owner, and he let us use his parking lot because it had those trees in the background, and it looked like a big open field where we could recreate our own festival.
Wow.
So those sequences, we threw up that tent. We had the Briar Patch clothing company set up their tent and bring their clothes and had all these extras come out in as many in costume as possible. That was like 50 people a day for 2 days. And we recreated a festival.
Well, you guys did a great job because you had me fooled. I was 100%, I thought it was the same thing.
That's where it looks like we spent money. And the only cost there was the cost of the porta cans, the porta toilets.
Oh, wow.
Which was like $200.
You have me convinced. I 100% tell you, perfect job. Because the editing, you did a great job in the editing to make it made sense to me, the editing.
Thank you.
So I'm giving you full credit on the editor, whoever did it. That made sense to me, that whole scene. I'm like, okay, because you went very close up in those shots. Like, you're very expansive earlier for your establishing shot, then you cut really close.
Yeah.
The dialogue, and it made sense to me that you would do that.
And that was the only way to do it, because if we stayed wide at our festival, it would have. And you can still, if you pay close attention, you can still see that it's a different place. But it's hidden well enough to where the first or second viewing you don't notice.
But I would argue that they move. You're walking around a convention. You're walking around a festival. So you would never shoot the same way. Like, they look like they're walking around having a conversation.
Exactly. And that's what we wanted. We wanted it to look big in a very small space.
You have me convinced. I'll give you that one 100%.
Thank you.
And then you have a gym.
Very validating.
I'm being honest. Like, I did watch the film, so, I mean, I'm not looking for mistakes, but I'm like, okay, I'm good. You have a gym scene. Is that the same gym from Lars, or is this a different one?
That is a different gym.
Oh, my God. You know everybody.
That would be a community college out in Pearland.
Okay. And you have a library. Yeah. How'd you get access to the library?
Another community college. I have a good friend who was a professor at the time who helped us get these locations.
Okay.
Yeah, so the library was very exciting to get because it was such an important part of the story. And, she got us permission to go film at this library on a weekend. So there were not a whole lot of students there, so we really had run of the place.
Okay. Can I jump around a bit in my questions, if that's okay?
Yes.
You have a shot. She goes to the library. She has to do her project at night. She clearly states that.
Yes.
You come out. It's bright and sunny.
What? We couldn't go to the library at night.
And so I'm calling you out on that shot. I'm like, oh, he just screwed up.
That's fine.
I was like, what?
Where we might reference doing something at night. But we just couldn't get the location at night. So there were some mistakes we had to eat.
And I figured that was what it was. I'm like, he can't be shooting at night there. That had to be it.
You're the only one that's pointed that out. So.
Oh, it bugged me immensely. I'm like, what's she doing at the library at night? Because that was my big question when she said that. I'm like, it's Friday night, and she has this paper, and she doesn't seem like the student that would wait to do her papers.
No. You know? She's, that's just one of those things we had to accept as a mistake if people notice it, and
I'm sorry.
One has pointed that out yet. So.
It was very just blaring to me, like, it's bright and sunny. That's like 12 noon heat. That's not...
Yes, you are absolutely right. It is, you can't. We didn't have the means to make it perfect. When you watch Lars, if you watch Lars again, there's a scene that's supposed to be taking place right at 12 noon, and it's clearly sunset because you can see the sun setting in the background.
Oh, okay.
So we just have to suspend your disbelief sometimes, and hopefully the story gets the audience through those continuity errors.
Oh, no, there were some issues with the story. It made me laugh.
But as a filmmaker, when you're doing it and you know there's a mistake, you just, fingers crossed, people aren't going to notice it.
Oh, and you have another one. And the other one I noticed is when right near the end of the film, the male cop is driving to the scene.
Yes.
And you've wiped out the scene. I'm like, there's the boom mic right there. The guy, you've done something to the window of the cop car to blur it out.
I have to see what you're talking about because
it's right near
the end. You're talking about.
I wish I had it in front of me. He's driving and he's talking on the phone to Sarah, and there's some weird scribbly thing on the screen. I'm like, Joe's been busy.
Is that when they're talking on the radio?
Yes.
There's two scenes where he pulls up before the golf course.
Yes, that's the one.
Okay, I'll have to look at that again because I'm still noticing mistakes in my film. Some things just go completely unnoticed.
I think you blurred out like a boom mic or something because something's been blurred out on the window.
I didn't.
Okay, then maybe it was just the coffee I had.
Yeah, the window was dirty.
Oh, maybe that's what it is because it looked awful.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm giving you that.
That could be.
Okay, let's go back.
And I'm wondering if the microphone. No, because the microphone was in the car.
Okay, then there's something on that window.
I'm going to go look at that again.
Okay.
Because I didn't do any digital hiding there, so it was either I didn't notice it or the window was dirty and it looked like we were hiding something.
Well, that's what it looked like to me. So I was like, okay, I'll let that go. And last thing I want to bring up before I even get into the film, Sarah designs jewelry now?
Oh, she always has designed jewelry.
Okay.
Yeah, she designs jewelry all the time, and she has it for sale. She used to have it in some retail her jewelry in retail locations. So she was actually pretty excited to design that amulet. We're talking about Sarah Gaston, who plays Detective Waters.
I know. Sorry, we talk about her so much now because she's in all your films.
No, she designed. We needed this amulet, and she said she would make it. So she created that from scratch.
I thought you'd be impressed. I knew that. I read the credits. I told you. Because you always bring up people, so I want to know who you were talking about for a change. Okay, now I want to go through the film. Is it a real auction?
No, we created the auction ourselves.
Okay, I was wondering
that. An antique store in Galveston. So we shot in Houston and Galveston and Austin. So the film
moves.
We shot in three cities. It was an antique store in Galveston, which is no longer there because of the flood years ago. But those were all extras, and George Manley is a big voice actor who I thought would make a great auctioneer. So we created. I've been to enough auctions myself to know how they work. But that was recreated from scratch, yeah.
Okay. Now, why snow globes?
Why what?
Why the snow globes?
I just thought it was funny.
So did I. So that's why.
We needed something, and I thought, okay, well, the water is a theme in the movie, so snow globes are full of water. It makes sense that this orb would be in a box of snow globes because it's a globe itself. So I thought it was funny, but it still made sense.
It did make sense. I thought it was funny, too, so I just like snow globes.
I just, just happened to have that puppy love snow globe from a collection of stuff I bought from an auction. And I thought, that's great. Let's just add that because that's perfect.
It worked for me. It worked. I did have a little bit of structural issue with the conversation between the teens before they go to the party.
Okay.
It's not your fault. It's the writing. I'm like, they don't speak like that, teens. It was not a teen conversation to me.
I'll accept that criticism.
I had no issues. But I understood what the scene was trying to establish. And why would they go to that terrible party? I couldn't figure that out. I'm like, she's got this paper. She's talking about it. And there's four of them. What the?
it's just, you know, not all parties are great, and you don't often know that till you get there. And, yeah, she was preoccupied, and I think she would have rather been home writing the paper.
Yes, I think so, too.
Yeah.
And before we get any further, what did you think? I liked your lead actress a lot. I thought she really worked well for the part.
I did, too, and she should have been my first choice. She was originally cast in the other female role.
Really?
Christy Strick's role. Jaren was cast as Cynthia.
Really?
And another actress was cast as Marla. It was one of the things we tried to do with the film, which did not work, was cast voice actors who were well-known in the anime community. And as we got closer to shooting, they just lost interest in working on the film. And I called Jaren and I said, I want to move you up to the lead. And she was thrilled. And she should have been my first choice all the time because she was just wonderful and I knew she would be. The gimmicky casting didn't work because we lost 4 actors that were voice actors, well-known voice actors at the last minute. And for reasons I don't know, one just said he didn't feel like he was up to doing the role. Because these guys are, the voice actors are used to just showing up to the studio, being handed the script right there, and doing the job without any preparation. Unlike a film where you have to learn everything, at least learn everything ahead of time, if not rehearse ahead of time. And it's just a much longer process, and I think that's what kind of turned them off at the last minute, realizing how long they were going to be involved, even if it was just one day, how long that day was going to be, versus going into the studio and doing 12 pages in 2 hours and being done with it forever.
Yeah. Christine's her friend, the one with the glasses?
Yes, that's Christy.
Yeah, she's good, too. I really liked her.
She's great. She comes from a theater background, so really worked. It really worked.
She seemed much stronger than Marla as an actress.
She had much more experience at the time.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, nothing against your lead. I liked her too, but I just thought the other one was a stronger actress.
And Jaren has moved on to music. She is becoming quite the singer and songwriter in Los Angeles.
Oh, great! And that's the lead, right?
Yeah, okay. That Jaren Julia is the lead, and okay. Christy Strick is the co-star.
Okay, where did you find her boyfriend?
Dimitri or Brandon?
The one at the end, the main leads. Sorry, I should write down these names.
Brandon worked. Brandon was referred to me by Sarah Gay Baston, who often refers really great people to work on my film. So they had worked together on, if I recall correctly, they had worked together on a show called The Toys Take Over Christmas, a kids' Christmas show that performed at the Hobby Center downtown Houston.
So this for kids?
Yes, that was a kids' show. And when we needed to replace the lead, which one of the actors that had to fall out was the lead actor, so she recommended Brandon, and I met Brandon and really liked him, and he accepted the part. I think it was his first lead role in film, maybe his first film role altogether.
He looks nervous.
He was.
Okay, because he comes off very nervous.
I was fine with it because it kind of fit the tone of his character. And I think he pulled off a fine job. But he readily admits he was nervous, at least for the first few shoot days.
Because you can see that. By the end of the film on the miniature golf course, he's very much better for the end scene.
Yeah, and I think I personally think it actually helps the arc of the character. If you can see that change.
I do.
Even if it's not the correct approach, I think it really helps his character at the end when he needs to be stronger.
Okay. And
it was written as a weak character to begin with. Jaren's part, Marla was always the strong one, and without giving away a spoiler, the plot point, obviously from the list, is Jackson has to grow as a character to fulfill his position.
Okay.
To fulfill his destiny, as you will. He needs to grow and be a stronger character at the end of the movie.
I liked your other lead, the other male lead.
But that would be Dimitri Kouzis.
No, her friend. That's the lead's friend, right? The guy that
the other boyfriend.
Love him.
Oh, he's wonderful. And he's a really good friend.
He's a good friend of yours?
Yes, yes. We were friends for a couple of years before casting him in that role, and he got the role when we auditioned him. We auditioned very few people, first of all, but he nailed "What the fuck, man?" at the audition, and that got him the role because he was so good with that one line.
Well,
it's Dimitri, it's yours.
Speaking of lines, I wrote down my favorite line in the movie: "The cock fits in a very convincing argument with you can't argue with physics."
Yes,
it made me laugh out loud. I'm like,
goes to Emilio. That's all immediate.
Yeah, Emilio's but the right. way he delivered it, it's so convincing.
And I think his performance benefits from not being a trained actor. He's a very funny guy and turning out to be a really good actor, but I don't think he had any formal training, which really worked for that character.
I don't think.
I think it's just a lot of that stuff he just said so naturally.
Yes.
Without acting it, knowing, oh, that's a punchline and it really needs to be delivered in a certain way. He just says it and it's right. I think that's because there's no formal training in his background. I could be wrong. I've never talked to him about acting training, but I never thought he had any formal training, and it worked for us wonderfully.
I think he does great. I really like him. He's probably my favorite character in the film.
Good, and a lot of people say that.
Because I think he's very strong, he's relaxed, he seems the one that seems to know what he's doing, besides Christine would be my second choice.
Yeah, and he's really great comic relief. Kyle Greer, the other friend, has some great comic scenes too, but
he does.
Two of them together provide some really great comedic moments in the film.
Kyle's the guy that takes the other guy to the strip club, right?
No, Kyle is the gay friend.
Oh, okay. Kyle's my favorite.
Yeah. Good, because he's a fan favorite for a lot of people too, yeah.
He makes sense. So let's talk about the night a bit.
Okay.
That beard, man, that is a quality beard.
Wayne Stevens will be very happy to hear you say that. Wayne owned the armor.
Okay.
So he was really the only choice for the role because he was the only one I think that would be comfortable in the armor for extended periods of time.
I was going to ask where you got some armor. I'm like, that stuff looks good.
That's from his personal collection. And the beard, I think he already had the beard. I did not request he grew it.
He must walk that 24/7. That's like a manly beard.
That Wayne, he's very proud of that beard.
Okay.
And it looked really good. I did have some hesitation with it in the opening scenes at the gym because they're supposed to be college students, but other people go to the gyms at colleges, and college students are of all different ages.
Yeah.
So I let that go. And it was fine. It was fine.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I got to go back to a party scene again, because you have a lot of parties in this, as you know. Why is Kyle cleaning up during the party?
Some people who host parties do that.
No,
I've been to parties where the host is like, oh, this place is a mess. Like, they regret having the party in the first place.
Is that what he is? Because I'm kind of
That makes perfect sense to me because I see hosts cleaning up at parties.
I don't know. I cleaned up a bit, but he seemed very neurotic about it.
We felt that was the character. It was funny.
It made me laugh. It did make me laugh.
Good.
I'm telling you. And then he goes in the backyard, and then the naked man walks in. He's like, "Hello."
Yes.
I thought that whole scene was great.
His tone changes suddenly, and it's wonderful. And of course, the trash was a plot device to get him out there to meet him.
Of course.
So, yeah, he was very frantic about cleaning up the party, and then suddenly, what was I even thinking about? Hello there, stranger.
I thought that was great. Whose house was that? Is this some house?
The house, the interior shots were my friend Kat and Marks, who are really big into Renaissance Festival stuff. That was, it was decorated. That was their, that's how their house was decorated.
Oh my God.
That we didn't have to do a thing other than show up and bring red Solo cups. The exterior scene where he meets the naked man was my parents' house. Completely different night.
Really?
And the shots where they went upstairs into the bedroom was my parents' house. So that's two different houses.
Again, perfect job of editing that, because you couldn't tell that.
Thank you. Yeah, you couldn't tell. And yeah, I really feel like we pulled some editing magic.
You did. You did.
Locations.
Jackson and Marla don't notice him? Really?
Which, the naked man?
Yes.
You've got to suspend your disbelief. Nobody noticed him walking through the party.
I thought that was kind of weird. I was kind of like, okay.
And, you know, if you think about it, there, he could have slipped in through that front door and right up the steps.
I gave it that, but I'm like, Jackson and Marla are noticing people watching them have sex. So I was kind of like, they probably could have noticed.
If they could have, but it's a party. And some, you, again, suspend your disbelief. It's a party.
I'm letting it go. I'm just going through my notes.
I know. No. Everything you're saying is a completely valid observation or criticism.
I'm not criticizing. No. Do not take the criticism.
And sometimes, again, you just have to assume, make some assumptions, and hope that the audience doesn't get that picky. As filmmakers and reviewers and film fans, we get really picky.
I'm not being picky. I'm just asking questions.
No. It's fine.
Okay. Sorry. I'm just like, okay.
No, I love it. I love these things being pointed out.
Well, now we're good friends. I can put you a little bit more grips to it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to ask him a little bit different questions for you.
No, this is great.
Okay, good. How did you do the woman in the water, and who is she?
That is Ann Quackenbush, who I've known almost as long as I've been doing this. She was in my first film, Laughing Boy. She played my wife.
Oh, you're in the first film I haven't seen.
That's the one you have not seen.
Okay.
I star in my first film. I have not in the others.
No, I haven't seen you. I do look for you every movie.
I have not made cameos.
And I thought you would have. Every film, I expect you to bump up.
And Lars the emo kid, my voice does, but I did not put myself on camera because I was operating the camera. And Dead of Night was operating the camera, too.
Okay.
So the lady in the water, the queen, is Ann Quackenbush, who is one of the finest actors in Houston. She's performed at the Alley Theater, which is the best theater, the professional theater in town, the top of the pyramid. Sarah Gaston has also performed there, and Celeste Roberts, who is also in Dead of Night, who plays Marla's mom, have all performed at the Alley Theater. Anne has been in three of my films, Laughing Boy, Dead of Night, and she was the teacher in Lars the Emo Kid.
Okay. I know who
she is. If you remember that.
Yes, I do.
We shot her scenes for Dead of Night in one day on a green screen, obviously, and Stig Daniels put her in the water.
I was wondering that. Like, well, it's got to be a green screen, but I'll ask it.
That was all green screen.
That's figured as much.
Yeah. But you and my first filming with green screen, by the way.
Yeah, okay, see, now I got to flip over my next set of notes, so... Okay, Paper the Britain Tony, Sarah. Oh, I was always excited when Sarah shows up. I even wrote my notes. Oh, Sarah shows up.
She loves that. She loves hearing it, that much, what a fan you are.
Oh, does she? You've told her?
I told her. I said, he raves about you.
I think she's really good. I wanted to see her do bigger work. I told you that. I think she's got the chops.
We are trying, you know. She actually recently got a role on a TV show called Your Worst Nightmare.
Nope, sorry.
It's one of these shows that films in Atlanta, and it's
good for her. It's great.
It's a small network show, and she just got cast in another show like that, so she'll be back in Atlanta.
That's awesome.
So she's getting some bigger opportunities.
I think she's good. Okay, we have to go to
opportunities that make her more visible.
The strip bar scene, which we have not touched on.
Yes.
Where. A real strip bar looked like to me or something. It must have been.
It was. And there's a real, I forgot if I talked about it in the commentary on the DVD, but there's a really great, somewhat scary story behind the strip club scene.
Okay.
That particular scene was filmed, and forgive me for forgetting the name of the location. But this, what you saw was the reshoot of the strip club scene. And the dancer's name is Kala Doll, C-A-L-L-A-D-O-L-L. That's her stage name. Look her up, a pretty well-known burlesque dancer here in Houston. Todd Cook is their buddy, who was also the gun instructor, the firing range instructor, and he's a professional skateboarder and filmmaker as well. We should have had a couple of extras in that scene, but we just had to, it was a reshoot that we had to do at the last minute, and we didn't have time, and it was fine. You know, it, with all the lights and stuff in the background, it looked good enough to me.
I thought it was a closed set. I took it as a closed set.
It was before they opened.
I knew that was. It's either open or it's the day they don't work at. I think it was like Monday afternoon you shot it.
Yeah, something like that. Now, the story behind the reshoot is the most interesting part of this. We had shot the scene with extras and everything at another strip club on Westheimer in Houston. Went to the manager, got permission, had a deal. If they let us shoot there, we're going to shoot a promotional video for them. Had it all worked out. We shoot, we get there, we're shooting, we're down to the last shot of the day, and the manager comes to us and says, you guys need to leave right now. And we're like, okay, we're going to respect your decision and get out of here. The owner showed up, who had no knowledge of us being there, and was pissed. Even we thought we were covered because we had permission to be there. The manager was with us all day. So we couldn't use the footage either.
Ooh.
And I don't know if I should. I might tell you the rest of the story privately because I don't know if it's smart for me to tell the rest of the story. But
well, nobody listens to this show at all, Joe. Nobody.
I'll tell you privately, and the next time we talk on the show, we can decide then if we want to bring it up.
Okay, we will. I'm going to bring it up.
It involves people on a most wanted list.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, so.
That's awesome. Well, I want to hear the story now.
Yeah.
So I want to go back. So this is
it would be wise to leave just to respect their wishes. And then later I found out why it was smart to leave right away.
So this is a real stripper then?
She's a burlesque dancer. I don't think Khaled does full nudity.
Okay. Burlesque dancer is different than stripper.
I was just grateful she was there and she looked wonderful.
Oh, she looked good. I'm like, wow, that's a really good looking extra.
She was better. The other stripper we had did full nudity for us, but Kala, even though she's hiding things, was much better.
Oh, okay.
And just really added much more to the scene.
I do have to ask, does that footage exist?
I have it. Yeah, I just didn't think it would be smart to release it.
Okay, because you're doing...
Yeah, I still have, you know, we shot this in 2006 and 7 where we were still shooting on tape. And I do. I still have all the tapes.
Wow, tape.
Yeah. Tape. It was expensive. You know, it was, what, $3 or $4 a tape, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it's a lot more than you spend with a $20 card now.
I lost where I was. Oh, let's discuss the golf course. I want to know all about it.
Yes. Where do you want to start with that? That was our second option. The first option was we wanted to do all those scenes at a golf course called the Malibu Grand Prix Castle. You might be familiar with Malibu Grand Prix arcades and go-kart tracks here in the States.
Nope. Never seen
one. There was a castle, a famous local landmark, a castle arcade that had a go-kart track next to it and three 18-hole putt-putt courses.
Whoa,
on the property.
Three.
And we filmed Laughing Boy there.
Okay.
So it would have been really exciting to go back. We filmed Laughing Boy there to look like an English castle, again, with editing and camera tricks. So we thought how great it would be to go back there and film there. Now that the property was abandoned, we would have run of it. And it would make sense that this guy would stake out at a castle that had been abandoned. It would have been really great, a really great visual and story element. But the new owners refused to let us go.
Oh.
So they wouldn't let us film there. So I struggled to find places. I thought, okay, I approached a garden pottery place and we had permission to shoot in a pottery, barn. I say pottery barn, not the store Pottery Barn, but it was a barn where they sold pottery.
I understood. I took it that way.
And I thought it would, you know, it still made sense. He would go into this place that visually it was good, but it didn't fit the castle, the medieval theme. But we had that as a plan. Then one day I knew this golf course in Galveston, and one day we were in Galveston, and I thought, what about that? And it turns out my friend Dan Braverman, who plays the other detective, Detective Sutherland, knew the owner of the golf course, the putt-putt course, and made a phone call, and they let us film there. And I thought, okay, this is wonderful. It has a castle that we can go in, and it would make sense that this guy would go there. And we pretend like it's abandoned, even though we're using their lights. You never see anybody else there. When we were filming, it was open for business for half our shoot day. We got to shoot it from 10 in the, or like 8 in the evening to midnight, and they close at 10. So we shot there for 4 nights. So 2 hours every night they were open for business. So we would have to stop filming while people played through our hole. So, you know, think of that. You're going there to play putt-putt, and here's an obstacle to film with a fully dressed knight.
I have a question then. This is 2007, so cell phone cameras aren't everywhere. So no more selfies then.
The cell phone pictures we took were very poor quality.
Could you imagine nowadays him sitting there, you doing this film, how many selfies that guy would have to take?
Oh, it would have been absolutely wonderful for us.
Because the promotion you guys would have had for that, your film?
No kidding. And I don't recall anyone stopping and saying, hey, can we take a picture with you?
Because nobody would have done it.
No, it wasn't commonplace yet.
Because I would have got a photo. I would have got my kids to take a photo with them.
And we would have loved it.
And I would have asked.
No, I don't recall anyone.
Weird how times change.
No one asked for pictures. There weren't a lot of selfies on set. I've never thought of that.
I was just thinking, like, that would be the number one thing would drive, I mean, it might drive him nuts, or maybe he didn't care, your main actor at the night. I was thinking, going.
But he would have loved it.
Okay.
Wayne, absolutely, he loves to show off that suit of armor, especially with him dressed in it.
Well, I'm just saying, he could have, just think of how many Facebook pages he would have popped up on.
Oh, yeah.
And he would have been quite
happy. Oh, now I'm going to remake the movie.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry about that. I was just thinking, going, he would be out a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do have some other minor questions.
Sure.
Something I've never asked you. Do you own your equipment or do you rent it?
I own my equipment now. I need to upgrade it, but at that time I borrowed that camera. We shot that on a Canon XL2, just for reference, which was an expensive tape camera at the time. And my friend Kelly let us borrow it when we needed it.
So, when you need equipment now, you own a sound boom, you own everything, so you can go shoot 20 minutes from now, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I own enough to film, yes. I don't have the most professional quality stuff, but what I have is adequate for $2,000 to $3,000 movies. It's more than adequate.
But I guess what I'm saying is, do you need professional equipment? I mean, your films look fine to me. For what the market you're going to, they work.
Personally, I don't see any reason to... I think I need to upgrade to 4K, you know, now that 4K cameras are so cheap. But then again, I want to find myself in a position now where I have support, where I have someone else operating the camera, and I want a DP on my projects. I don't want to shoot my own stuff anymore.
Well, I can see
that. So, no, and with that being said, no, I don't feel the need to own my own equipment, because if I'm going to hire someone to shoot it, they're going to have their own stuff, and they're going to have hopefully the most current tools.
So do you find after you've made three, I think you're on your fifth movie now?
The next one will be my fifth, yes.
Do you find, like, that you have enough collection of people to help you out, I guess I'm trying to say? Like, you have enough extras from your job, you know people, like, you're good to go.
Yes, I don't think I have any problem finding people. Even if I wanted to do another movie for $3,000, I think I could find the people. I'm trying not to do that again.
So you're about your budget then?
We're trying to raise money for the next one.
Now, can I go into that for a second? How are you raising your money, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I'm very interested in that lately.
I've paid for my own stuff.
Right. So the next film, you said you're trying to raise money, though.
Yeah, for the next one, we've got a commitment of like $8,000. We did a Kickstarter a couple of years ago, and I think we raised $8,000 to $12,000. I don't recall. It was at least $8,000. I got a commitment for another $5,000 from an investor. And Courtney Sandifer, the writer-producer of Kids vs. Zombies, is kind of in charge of that right now. We're just trying to get some more paperwork in order so we can have our bases covered.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
And it was important to me to get all my films released before I even approach any investors. So that's why a couple of years ago I had this rush to get everything out on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
DVD and so on, because I'm not comfortable sitting down with an investor not knowing how they're going to recoup. Now I know here are some ways we're making money that I can share with you. There are other ways, but now I can say this is how much Dead of Night has made, and I can show them records from Amazon.
Good.
Which in the past I hadn't been able to do, to show real records of money that I actually received.
Okay, good. Sorry I'm asking you hard questions, maybe.
No, I love the hard questions.
Okay, I'm just interested in this lately. The more I get into this, the more these questions are coming to me. Now, I always like to ask about catering because I like to eat. So how has the catering worked on the shoot?
Various ways. Going back to my first film, Laughing Boy, my friend Jeannie Flannery cooked for us every day.
Oh, so I like her already.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She cooked for us every day, which was a great privilege and benefit to the film, and people loved it because, you know, food keeps people happy.
Oh, I agree.
Lars, the emo kid, we just had someone run out for Subway sandwiches or pizza. A tip for filmmakers, don't feed your crew pizza too much. Just maybe one day a week because that slows people down.
I was thinking that.
Yeah. So we had someone run to Subway or a sandwich place every day. After taking orders, Dead of Night, often we shot such short days because we didn't have to have any catering.
Okay.
You know, it was shoot when we can, so sometimes we'd have a 3 or 4 hour shoot day. Rarely did we have a 12-hour day, but when we did sandwiches or pizza or something. And same with Lars.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of sandwiches. And conjoined, again, Subway was a block away from the studio we filmed at.
Oh, good. I don't see Kiefer again. I was upset that Kiefer hasn't shown up again.
She went to Florida for a short time.
Oh, okay.
She's back in Houston now. I keep pushing Chuck Norfolk to write a sequel for Conjoined.
Okay.
But I just can't get them to, I can't get them motivated to do it.
Back to your film. So your film is in the can. Dead of Night is done. You've taken it to Amazon. Did you do something for it before that?
Yeah, we before we started recording, we talked about delays and problems with films. And Dead of Night has its problems. And if we don't talk about the problems, how do other people learn? We showed it. We filmed it in 2006, 2007, 2008. So it was a 16-month shoot.
Wow.
You know, it was spread out. And that's – a lot of the actors really lost interest because it took so long, and I don't blame them one bit. So that's one problem we had. We premiered it in 2010, but it was flawed. It had problems that I thought could be fixed, some continuity errors, some digital glitches in the effects with the Queen. I really struggled. I wanted it to be as good as it possibly could. And skipping ahead to today, it just didn't matter. People still enjoy it, and they overlook the flaws because the actors and the story is engaging. But these flaws that I thought could be fixed delayed the film from being released for like 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so we actually made and finished and released Conjoined before Dead of Night was readily available.
Wow, I'm shocked.
So Conjoined was an effort to fix all those problems.
Okay.
And to prove ourselves that a lot of these problems, continuity and whatnot, just don't matter if the audience is entertained. And it proved to be true. Conjoined is full of continuity problems, which we made part of the fun.
Who cares? I love Conjoined.
Exactly. Who cares? And it's what I learned from it is these films are never going to be perfect. I finally said, okay, I have to quit working on Dead of Night. And we worked on older technology, which became obsolete, so we couldn't edit it anymore. There's nothing else I could do because we didn't have access to the old computers. So I said, I have to release it. And then lo and behold, it didn't matter. The problems didn't matter. People still like the film.
Yeah, I'm with them. I don't think if you're happy with what you have, put it out there.
I thought the problems were going to be a big deal to people.
No.
And they're not. And that was the big lesson for Dead of Night and Conjoined is you just have to live with these problems, and chances are people aren't going to notice.
Have you heard my podcast? I can't edit to save my life, and I don't care. I just give out. and I'm honest about that.
You know, when the movie's over, were you entertained? That's right. All I'm worried about now.
And I'm with you the same
way. I want everything to be good. But the most important thing when it's all over is, did you entertain this audience?
That's the same argument I have with the podcast. Did you enjoy listening to it? Yep. Then that's all that matters.
Right.
And that's
right.
What I look at. Okay. Fun questions for you. I think we can take big breath. I've rated you pretty hard this one, so.
Okay.
First movie you ever saw?
The first movie I remember ever seeing, and I'd have to put a couple out here.
Okay.
It was probably a Disney animated film. One of the earliest I remember would be like The Rescuers.
The first one or the second one?
The first one. Okay. We're talking the 70s.
Did you get your that crocodile scare the crap out of you too?
I think so.
When the kid,
early movie memories include that, King Kong, the 77 King Kong.
Well, that was on TV. 76.
The 70s Kong.
Which I don't think it's a good film at all.
And H.G. Wells movies like Empire of the Dance and Food of the Gods were some very early childhood memories. But my first, I don't recall what my first movie was, but it was probably a Disney film.
Okay. The worst film you've ever seen in the theaters.
The worst film I've ever seen in the theaters. That privilege is going to go to a movie called A Man Called Sarge.
I have not seen it.
And just a couple of years ago, I decided, because I don't walk out of movies. It's very rare that I walk out of movies, and that would be probably one of five or six movies that I've ever walked out on. And it was an airplane-style comedy.
Yes.
That didn't work. Think how painful that is to watch.
Yeah, that would be.
When the jokes completely fall flat. And recently, a couple of years ago, I thought, okay, I'm going to find this. And it was on Netflix, and it actually took me like three or four nights to get through it.
It's still terrible.
It's like, oh, boy, this is a great lesson on why comedy is so hard. Watch A Man Called Sarge.
Oh.
Other movies I walked out of include Destiny Turns on the Radio.
Terrible. I saw that in theaters, too. Terrible.
The remake, the Corey Squared remake of Dream a Little Dream.
I've not seen.
I walked out of School Days, but that's only because I know it's a good movie. It just wasn't my thing.
I can't remember if I've ever seen School Days. I'd have to check.
Spike Lee's School Days? That's not a rip on the movie. It just wasn't my thing.
Somebody wanted to hammer me.
It wasn't meant for me.
My Spike Lee watching is minimal.
Yeah. Mine too. But I did like Do the Right Thing.
Which I still have not seen. It's probably the biggest film my need to watch list.
Yeah, it's really good. And the other one I walked out of is escaping me.
It's all good. Okay.
I did sit through Soul Plane, but I complained afterwards and got a free ticket to come back and see something else.
Soul Plane is terrible. I have seen Soul Plane. My brother rented it, and I'm like, this is unwatchable.
But A Man Called Sarge, to me, is just a very fascinating bad movie. And it's not even The Room bad. Even though it could be, it just didn't get that cult status. No one I know has heard of the movie.
I've never heard of it.
And it was a theatrical release.
I've seen The Room. I love The Room. I could watch Room over and over again.
The Room is great now. And, but Man Called Sarge, none of my friends know about it.
Why? Why?
It's like, I don't know why it stuck with me. It's just like this thing that I obsess with every now and then. It's like, and when I finally watched it, I go, wow, I think I've actually got a grasp of this comedy thing. I get it. This didn't work. I might do some research behind that movie and see why it exists.
Well, The Room convinced me I could make a movie.
Was it money being laundered?
Could have been. Who knows? Okay, this is the easiest. Well, maybe not the easiest. I walk into your house. I look at your collection of movies. What's the one film that stands out? I'm like, why is that there?
Oh, yeah. I think we touched on this.
We did.
Last night.
We did a little bit.
And I may have not grasped the question.
And I want you to think about it. Is it a romance film? Like something like, I expect a lot of horror on your shelf. Some action.
There is Babe.
There we go. See, that's what I was looking for. Last time we grasped it a bit, I want to go that one film. I'll be like, why is this on your shelf, Joe?
If you know my films and you're familiar with Conjoined and Dead of Night and that's what you're introduced to.
Yes.
You'll understand the horror films on my movie shelf.
Yes.
If you don't know me, you would see Babe and go, why is that there? But if you know me, it would make perfect sense because it's a really good movie.
It is.
And even if it's, you don't like talking animal movies, Babe is just a fascinating movie.
I don't have any issues with talking animal movies. Talking babies, I have a lot of issues with.
I don't think I have any talking baby movies.
Look who's talking.
But Babe, one of the things, when I make my films, I don't necessarily know what has influenced me until after I watch the film. Because I don't sit down to make a film and go, I want this to look like Kubrick. I want this to look like Scorsese. I don't think that way. I want to do what's best for that scene and that story. But I can watch my films after the fact and say, okay, well, I know what influenced that.
Yeah, okay, good.
Take the end of Lars the Emo Kid, and I recently watched Babe, and I realized, okay, well, that influenced the sound design decision I made for Lars. If you think about the end of Babe where there's no music during that final competition.
I haven't seen Babe since it came out, so.
Where other filmmakers might put this grand music to inspire, these filmmakers chose not to put any music there during Babe's performance at the end until the judges place their score, then the big inspirational cue came in, but the whole action had no music and it was absolutely wonderful and perfect. So from a filmmaking point and a storytelling point, that's probably the most important thing I take away from Babe.
Cool. I do have one thing I need to touch on because you didn't even touch on it.
Okay.
Joe make return to DVD or something? You didn't mention it at all, so I'm going to bring it up.
It's a short film I wrote.
Okay.
Hopefully by the time this podcast goes on the air, we will have wrapped. But I started writing a short film. Well, actually, I wanted to make it a feature called Joe Returns a Video. And it's about me returning a copy of Steven Seagal's Above the Law on VHS 30 years late.
Okay.
And it was really an excuse just to meet a bunch of odd characters on the way there.
Great.
Choosing to walk instead of drive, I get to talk to all my neighbors, and that's where the fun is.
I'm not going to go any more into it because I know we're going to do it, so I'm going to stop you there.
It's going to be like a 12-minute short film.
That's fine. You'll talk for an hour about it. I'm not worried.
Hashtag Joe returns a video.
Yes.
You can speak some of the stuff about it.
Well, it's always fun. Thank you for your time.
Thank you again for your time.
Oh, we always have fun. It's like meeting old friends. We always have something to talk about, so I never have any issues.
And just so everyone knows, Dead of Night with a K is on Amazon Prime, so you can watch it for free. If you don't have Prime and you don't want to pay, it's also on YouTube on the Kings of Horror channel.
And Amazon Prime is in Canada now.
Amazon Prime. It's and you can also find it on some Roku channels. So make sure you get your Roku.
Joe, it's in Canada. We just got it in December.
Oh, you have Roku now?
No, we have Amazon Prime. Just showed up.
Oh, okay. Yes, then all my films are on Amazon Prime for free.
Okay, so you don't have to clarify it's here. We have it now in Canada. You're good to go.
Okay, I'm going to check that out. I didn't know that.
Yeah, just December 16th or something.
I would love to know if you can access my films or if I need to go and...
I will check on it for you, I promise.
Check on
it,
because I would love to know that.
I have no idea. I don't have it yet. A friend of mine just signed up.
But I think you can go to Amazon Canada and find it then.
Okay, I'll check with him tonight.
Without being, you may not be able to watch it, but it should be visible to you if that's the case.
I will check on it for you.
Awesome, I appreciate that.
Okay, have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye.